Good morning, and may it please the court. In Time Warner 2, this court rejected the commission's 30% horizontal cap after finding that it exceeded the commission's legal authority, ignored the relevance of competition from DBS, and relied on factually unsupported assumptions. The court told the commission expressly that on remand it would have to consider the relevance of competition from DBS and the determinants of market power for cable. That was 8 years ago. And in the interim, the video programming distribution market has become even more competitive and dynamic. DBS, which was 15% at the time the court wrote Time Warner 2, is now 33% of MVPD households. And the national telephone companies have entered this market aggressively and in a very short time have garnered millions of customers. Indeed, while Comcast is now number one in MVPD subscribers, the two DBS providers, Dish DirecTV and Dish, are now numbers 2 and 3 respectively. Verizon.
Pardon me, they're 2 and 3 in a market including everybody?
Yes, top 10 MVPDs, Your Honor. Comcast is number one today. DirecTV is number two. Dish is number three. And Verizon, which was not even in this business until barely 2 years ago, is number nine. Now, in spite of all of this, and much like a stop clock that always gives you the same number, the commission has once again used an open field analysis and once again come up with a magic 30% number. And how does the magic work? Well, let me just sort of give you three examples that are emblematic. I will spend some time then discussing the specific failings of the two key aspects of this, the minimum viable scale and the penetration rate.
Before you do, just staying with what your point about the dynamism of the market.
And yes,
the statute requires the commission to take account of the dynamism of the market. At the same time, as a practical matter, they have to close the record at some point, and it might be a few years until there's a final decision from the agency and review by the court.
Yes, of course. I will point out, however, Judge Ginsburg, that is a question of reasonableness. For example, in Time Warner 2...
But they couldn't. There's no way they could have picked up Verizon's impact on this.
Oh, no, of course not. But I think it goes to whether the model that they have adopted under this statute that does require them to take account of market conditions has the dynamism that is really needed to incorporate what Congress has in mind. And the most telling example of what's wrong with the entire approach is that under the commission's formula, if instead of going from 15% to 33%, DBS had gone from 15% to 70%, 7-0, the inputs in the formula will remain exactly identical, and cable would be limited to 30% of all MVPD homes. And that's clearly an absurd outcome. Now, let me tell you how that works. I mean, there are three components to this formula that are important. The numerator is the minimum viable scale, MVS. That's on top. The denominator is a product of the total number of MVPD subscribers and what the commission now calls the penetration rate. Under the commission's open field analysis, two of those inputs, two of those inputs, DBS is completely irrelevant. The only one of those three inputs that has any input from DBS is the total number of MVPD subscribers. Now, to be sure, that keeps the cap from falling in tandem with the falling market share of cable, which in 1992 was about 95% or so, and today, with luck, is probably about 64%. But it doesn't really account for DBS in the other two key variables, as this court told the commission to do. Now, why is that? In 2001, Time Warner 2 saw little point, as the court put it, and this is at the top of page 1134, in even looking at the commission's assessment of what the market looked at then, because the court could see that the dynamic increases in DBS were such that, you know, there was no point in even looking at data that was then 2 years old. That was in 2001. This court said, we're not even going to look at this. This is changing so fast. So go back. And so let's start with how the commission dealt with that. Minimum viable scale. This is supposed to be the basic building block of the commission's approach, as the commission put it in paragraph 40 of its order. And it is supposed to be the minimum number of subscribers that a new network requires in order to be viable. Now, under the FCC's approach, that minimum number is 19 million, because according to its network survival study, 19 million happens to be the average number of subscribers that a successful network has after 5 years. Now, every step of that analysis is wrong. In summary, number one, the statute defines video programming, and it appears to me, as a matter of Chevron 1, to be pretty clearly concerned with programs, shows, not networks. Number two, even on the—
Doesn't it refer to networks in other parts of the statute pretty clearly? Doesn't
right, that and that is one of our main points on that point, Judge Kavanaugh. I think Section 534B4 and 5, you know, the must-carry provisions.
Right, but doesn't it refer to video programming in a way that suggests it's referring to networks?
No, I don't. I mean, there are some reference in other parts of the statute to cable programming, but for purposes of the analysis of what's at issue in this case, you know, the most telling indication of the commission going awry is that under the commission's approach here, even though the definition of video programming in 522.20 says that is programming provided by or comparable to that of broadcast stations, under the commission's approach, broadcast stations are excluded, even though their programming provided by them is explicitly included in the statutory definition.
What does the word video add to that? Because some of these stations are just audio, is that
right? I mean, this was placed in the statute in the Cable Act of 1984. I think Congress was starting to look at the, you know, now we're talking about the definition only, looking certainly at some issues with cable. But ultimately, I mean, I don't want to belabor the point because I do think, you know, that the statute does speak for itself.
At a minimum, it at least includes independent programming producers, right?
Correct. Yeah. And one of the things that is somewhat astounding about the case is that after this case was sent back to the commission in 2001, the first notice of proposed rulemaking that the commission put out showed that it clearly understood what the tiers or layers that were relevant in the market were. Because for purposes of coming out of the gate in 2001, the commission said, as we see it, we're talking here about, you know, the relevance of people who make programs. Then there are people who bundle programs, and those would be networks. And then there would be the people who are essentially like Comcast and other cable companies, you know, the conduits. You know, the commission never came back or explained why that was not more in keeping with the statutory definition. And the important point, and really why this is relevant, is that if you're looking about minimum viable scale, what does the programmer, the content provider need in order to be viable? If you posit to consider that there are hundreds of existing broadcast cable and DBS networks, anyone who is the person who's going to bring you the next Sopranos or the next, you know, Crazy Wives of X City.
Or the next what?
Bear with me, Judge Ginsburg. I don't actually really watch that much television, but I gather that there is some series of shows involving desperate housewives from various cities. And the point is, that is a block of content, a show that would be appealing to consumers, if you're the person who is the creative mind who's going to bring that to the consumer, Congress could not have anticipated that in order to do that, you also had to build a new cable network to do so. And there are existing hundreds of outlets for that. But that's, you know, first.
All of this was in your first point.
No doubt. It's a long order and it's many errors.
That the numerator was too narrowly.
Yes, and defined. This is my first point having to do with the numerator. Sticking with minimum viable scale and still the 19 million number. My second point is that even if the network survival study, which is where this number comes from, were completely accurate and up to date, it would be better than a signed text issued yesterday. The commission misused it, number one, because the commission confused correlation with causality. Just because you have 19 million subscribers at year five and you are successful doesn't mean that you are successful because you have that many. On the commission's theory, if I do a survey of baseball of baseball and find that anybody who's batting 333 gets over 2 million a year, I could easily conclude that if the Yankees sign me up, I'll have a batting average of 333, which clearly would not be the case. It confuses correlation and causation.
Signed you up for 2 million, you mean?
Yes, of course. Would I work for anything under that? yes, I would, obviously. But in any event, so that's the first misuse of the commission study. Now, the second one.
For a moment.
Yes.
So is your point that the finding that the persistent or successful stations, not stations, but network sources, had on average 19 million, that association doesn't mean that they were successful because they had 19
Correct.
Million.
I mean,
but they were successful because they had some number of subscribers, right?
Well, they were successful most probably because they're any good.
Paid because people watched them.
Well, sure. But again, one of the things that the open field approach inherently does not take into account is, you know, any notion of real quality or why people are successful or conversely why they're failed. I mean, you know, it sort of assumes inherently that the largest cable company will turn, you know, the new network down for any reason, good, bad, or indifferent, including this show is a stinker.
You're kind of losing me. These are the shows that were successful, or the channels that were successful.
Yes, and I was not talking about those. I was talking about a premise of the open field analysis,
okay, which I just wanted to make sure I'm
saying no.
Objection.
My apologies for that.
Is this different than your objection that they shouldn't use an average?
Yes, it is different from that objection. I had not gotten that
objection. So, okay. Go
yes.
ahead, then.
Well, I mean, you know, the point is simple. Just because you are successful with 19 million subscribers doesn't mean that that is the absolute minimum you need
to
be successful.
That's part of your averaging objection.
In part.
The average is not the same, not
in
the
part.
Right cutoff.
Yes.
What is the right
cutoff? Now I see what you're asking.
So what is the right cutoff point?
Well,
one standard deviation below the average?
Well, I don't know because the commission did not purport to investigate that question. Of course, I could offer any number of alternatives, and under Chenery, they would not be any good since the commission did not actually invoke them. But I think even putting that aside, I mean, you know, the most fundamental failing, even assuming that the study is really wholly writ, is that the commission simply misread the study. And for that proposition, I will ask you to look at volume 4 of the joint appendix. That's where the study is, and it's page 2346 of the appendix. Now, this failing has to do with the fact that the commission is looking at the number of subscribers a successful network has in year 5. today is not 5 years from now. And if you look at the conclusion that the study has, it says simply, 19 million at year five. Next sentence. Recall, however, that a network requires far fewer subscribers for survival if it acquires all of those subscribers from day one. And it goes on to say, on that premise, the day one premise, the correct number is 10.18 million subscribers. Now, if you accepted everything else that the commission has done in that case and simply swapped 10 million for 19 million, the cap would be 61%. And so, you could ignore everything I said today, which please don't, and it would still be true that a simple misreading of a basic input shows that the cap is hopelessly awry, and also true that when you look at the correct input, you see that each of the DBS stations by itself has more than enough subscribers to satisfy the minimum viable scale of 10 million subscribers.
I'm going to ask you to repeat one part of this.
Of course.
Tell me why, again, 10.18 is the number they should have taken from the network study.
Because what the study says is if you start with 10.19 and you have, the expected rates of growth for a successful network, you will have 19 5 years from now. But if you're looking to start a new network, even assuming that's the correct gauge, the correct day is today when you're starting that network, not 5 years from now. And the study goes on expressly to say, if you acquire 10 million from day one, you will have the same 70% chance of success than if you had 19 at year five.
I haven't read this study, but I admit my ignorance of this whole business, so maybe you can help me out. When you talk about 19 million or 10 million, you're not talking about that's not the number of people that watch this network, right?
No.
That's just the number of people that through their cable subscription get the network.
Well, that is in the commission's formula is intended to be solely the minimum number of subscribers the network would have to get to watch it in order to be successful. There's a separate part.
How do you know, though? If it's part of a package, how do you decide? How does one decide that, wow, this gets, there are 19 million people that took this package, and now they have 200 channels?
Well, I think as a practical matter, what the commission looks at is how many people have the tier that includes that network. And so, the other part of your question has to do with...
If it's a premium, I can see it. But if it's part of the standard package, I find it very difficult to...
Right. And that aspect, which goes to how many people are likely to ultimately get it, is in the denominator of the commission's formula and is included in what the commission called DBS. The penetration rate. I have a DBS in my mind because the last point I want to get to, which is true both of the minimum viable scale and of the penetration rate, is that the key aspect of this court's ruling in Time Warner 2 was you have to look at DBS. And if you look at the data set of this study, all of the data came from 1984 to 2001. 1984 to 2001. And three pages earlier at 2342, this study explains that we took something called, the cable fact book. It's a trade book. And you pulled it out, and if a network was there in 1984 but wasn't there in 1987, in the 87 book, you sort of assume that it failed, unless it showed up in another later book. But the key point here is there was no DBS from 1984 to 1992. There was no DBS in 1992. It was authorized, but as the commission's own filings have shown, it was not even operational in 1992, and that's at JA 374, 78, I believe. 4 years,
Well, but all that's really subsumed within your first point that it was at 15% in 2001. It was 30 or 33.
15 million. Well, oh, yes. The DBS, yes.
And is it 30 or 33% now?
Well, right, and that has to do with the change in the market, but...
So if it was at 15, then it was at lower numbers earlier, that's all, right?
In part, but it is also true that that in setting this key variable, the data excluded most of the period where there was DBS, and therefore it could not, as the commission says, inherently have all of the DBS information baked in. That's the key point about that, because even though it is quite clear to us that DBS had no role in the minimum viable scale, the numerator or the penetration rate, with respect to the penetration rate, you know, the commission says, you got us. Footnote 208, we did not do DBS. We considered whether people actually will get it based on the tiers issue, but we didn't even look at
they say
DBS.
You never asked us to.
Well, that I take it is the waiver argument, and I think that actually is quite unfounded, because in the first place it was, you know, the mandate of this court. You know, the court looked at the then MVS number, which was then 15 million, and the penetration rate, which is now 27, it was then 50. And this court expressly said, look at DBS in doing that.
Actually, the court said, look, you know, the normal situation is that market power is not determined solely by the share of the market, but also by the elasticity of supply and demand. And the FCC has not given us any logic to show why that normal rule doesn't apply. Well, the FCC has now given some logic about why the normal rule doesn't apply. They talk about inertia and bundling and so on and so forth. You come back and you say, no, that can't be right, because all these people, 50% of the, whatever these numbers are, 50% of the people that now have satellite TV had cable before, right? Uh-huh. That, I don't know that that's responsive. The question is, what the court was talking about in Time Warner 2 is whether a customer would switch because he's not getting or she's not getting a network that's carried on another carrier, like satellite. And I don't know, where's the evidence of that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of evidence on that. I mean, there's a question.
That's the question. It's not, you know, people may switch from Comcast to satellite because the service that Comcast provides is terrible. That doesn't affect this at all.
Well,
what we're talking about is switching because of a new network is not being carried. And so that's a very different question.
At every opportunity, just Randolph, we put in writing after writing and submission after submission on the impact of DBS on all of these issues, including filings in 2007 in May and in December, having to do with the fact that the penetration rate, which was formerly in Time Warner 2, 50%, could not be any lower than 70. Now, the question that you say about, you know, whether the commission answered the task you put to them, the best answer for that comes from the commission itself, which got around to it in paragraph 69 of its order and said, we find this quite difficult. But in any event, let me give you three reasons, this is paragraph 70, why we think that people are unlikely to switch. You know, the first one is it's sort of costly. Footnote, which I think is 236, every item of evidence in the footnote that purportedly supports that assertion, and we put tons of evidence on the other side, but every item of evidence that the commission cited for that showed how difficult it is to switch from DBS to cable, because, not to put it unkindly, when DBS gets its hooks into you, they try not to let you go, and they say, we're going to sign you for a one-year contract, et cetera, et cetera. There's not a single item of evidence cited for the proposition that it is difficult to switch from cable to DBS, and the fact that that DBS is growing and has grown like gangbusters would seem to cast grave doubt on that proposition. Second reason.
I didn't understand the evidence that way. The evidence in 236, well, the footnote 236 begins after a citation with the following sentence. For example, DBS providers typically require customers to agree to one-year service commitments to receive subsidized equipment and installation. Uh-huh. And then they go on, if you don't meet the credit requirements, it can be more difficult. That suggests a reason for that it's difficult to switch from cable to DBS, does it not?
Well, not in the way that the commission actually put it, because if you read on, it says, yes, of course, they will give you a break and a credit on your bill for all of this outlay, but only if you stick around. And so it can be quite easy to switch, but it's like the Hotel California. You can never leave.
It's more like the Roach Motel.
Well, we would like to think so, but... But you know, just to move on to the second point that the commission gave, because I think it is important. It was, well, you have other bundled services, phone, internet, whatnot. I mean, we put in evidence as well that so does DBS. DBS have teamed up with the telcos to offer packages too. And of course, there is nothing inherently in a market that says that you have to buy bundled services.
DBS provides telephone service?
They have teamed up with some of the telephone companies to offer up bundled services, Your Honor, including through the telephone aspect of it, internet and telephone services.
Oh, so it's not the so DirecTV or Dish Network are not providing the telephone.
No, but I think they have a deal that makes it available as a bundle
to the
consumer. And of course, people have unbundled phone service since 100 years ago, and it is possible you can get it, right? Again, more to the point, to the extent that bundling can be any sort of issue that would deter people from switching from cable to DBS, the commission cited no evidence to sort of quantify, analyze, explore it, only a speculation that this is so, which is, you know, not only insufficient as a matter of APA law, but also insufficient even under intermediate scrutiny, because of course you have to have some basis for restricting the speech of cable that goes beyond the speculation.
Your answer to their third point was that consumers are unlikely to switch to gain access to new programming because they
don't know what it is.
Don't know how
and
to sample
that
it.
Is my absolute favorite, Judge Ginsburg.
But your objection was simply that in your reply brief, you said there are numerous ways, and you never mentioned one. What else?
Well, okay. I'm sorry. When I read that, I had this image of the commission actually thinking that the average consumer of video services is the Unabomber, right? Because this is a person that lives in a cabin in Montana, has no water and not electricity, but somehow Comcast cable service. And he's never going to hear of a show by talking to a coworker, by seeing it on the internet, by seeing an ad for it on the service that he does have. If you step off on the curb in Washington, D.C., it is impossible to see a bus go by without a huge board of a half-clad woman with the show, you know, The Tudors, which is something offered on Showtime. And so the notion that a consumer will be absolutely ignorant of a show that may be of interest to him does.
Advertising was one, and what was it, colleagues or friends telling?
Colleagues and friends on the internet, living in any environment that calls for human contact.
And they advertise on each other's distribution channels?
Sure. I mean, you know, you can have ads for shows in all sorts of media.
If I'm looking at Fios, and it doesn't carry a certain channel, DirecTV might buy an ad on Verizon that says, watch our program.
I don't have Fios service. Of course, I have Comcast. And obviously, since they only started service, I think, in September
06. Is that how they found you?
No, I actually think that they started with the yellow pages, and I have a name that starts with an E. It does happen. Even I, who don't watch all that much TV, can sort of channel flip and see the ads for the other shows and the other networks.
That are not carried by your carrier.
Sure. Just some channel flipping. But again, I mean, it is one of those things that is so threadbare and so speculative that it's just, you know, manifestly contrary to basic human nature.
Then you make the point that the MSOs are providing upgrades all the time, expensive things like digital programming mm-hmm. and video on demand and so on. Mm-hmm. And ask sort of rhetorically, why would they be doing this if it weren't to, if transaction costs made their customers captives anyway, right?
Essentially, yes.
Isn't it the answer that they charge additional for those services?
Well, I mean, not really, Judge Ginsburg, because I think on a per channel basis, cable prices have gone down, and I really
if the cable company adds HD capacity, do they give it away at the same subscription price, or do they ask for an additional fee?
Well, I don't know, because I think it depends on where you choose to place it on the existing tiers.
Well, you said there's no reason to make these massive investments, right, if the customers can't leave.
But that's clearly
maybe true. There is a reason, which is that you can charge more.
Yeah, but I don't think you would find in the record that being a reasonable explanation for the level of investment that the record actually reflects. Just as a matter of public record and the record, I think Comcast has probably spent $50 billion with a B trying to upgrade in the last 10 years or so. If people were not called by the allure of DBS and they were truly captive and the switching costs were really prohibitive, you would not expect any rational economic actor to do something like that, even if it could charge incrementally some fraction of that to the customers. That's just not economically rational.
The only thing the statute says is take particular account uh-huh. of market structure. And you raise a First Amendment claim. And it's reminiscent of another statute in the First Amendment decision of the Supreme Court that said the same thing. Are you familiar with the Finley case?
From many years ago, Your Honor, yes.
That said, take into account the standards of decency that are common to, and the Supreme Court held that in the First Amendment area, take into account just means that's just aspiration. Why isn't that the same thing?
Well, I don't think that the question in front of the court in that case was really so much one of statutory construction in the sense that it is here, because this
statutory interpretation.
Well,
Justice Scalia dissented on that.
In the sense that it is here, because the statutory interpretation, I think, that is relevant has already come to this court in the Time Warner 2 case. And you may recall that if the statute were wholly of that type, Time Warner 2 was faced with the commission's claim that it could impose speech limits solely in the name of diversity, which is, frankly, a claim that the FCC has made with favor in other contexts. And this court, speaking through Judge Williams, said a fair reading of the statute says that Congress had the specific intent to curtail the abuse of market power while promoting growth when appropriate. And therefore, unless you can link the diversity precept to some anti-competitive status or conduct that needs to be dealt with, you cannot really invoke that type of rationale. Now, if the statute were truly of the type that you suggest, a la Findlay, you could easily say that all of these things being aspirational really ought to be no constraint on what the commission can do in that.
It into account. We took it into account. You said we didn't take it into account in Time Warner 2, and now we have.
Well, I mean,
when we take it into account, what does the statute say we should do with it? It doesn't. It doesn't give us any instruction about, take it into account. What do we do with it?
Well, I think the statute is a little bit more specific than that, Judge Randall. Now, in fairness, I mean, first, subsection F is entitled Effective Competition. Now, subsection F1 has like three things that the commission has to consider to promote effective competition, and F2 gives you all of these items that you say the commission has to take into account. I would say it is what informs, the meaning of effective competition in the section, and at the gate we have the proposition that this is about preventing unfair impediments to the flow of video programming. So I think that there
is more than networks.
Right. And in addition, it doesn't really say, I mean, it does really call upon the petition in the same way that intermediate scrutiny does to say what are the non-conjectural actual harms that are being addressed here. How have you addressed them in a way that is really reasonably tailored to the purported harm, and not merely simply a question of there are a lot of relevant factors. We've considered them. They're all in there, and we can now move on. I mean, there is a reason.
What I'm suggesting is that you are imparting more precision into the statute than that on the face of it the statute requires. Take into account, consider this, consider that, with absolutely no weights assigned to any of the considerations. You know, it kind of sounds like the Establishment Clause.
Oh, no, nothing could be that messy. Nothing could be that messy. Although I think it is true that there is guidance, and that much is true, and there is guidance offered for the purpose of furthering effective competition. And again, you can look at Section 2 of the statute as this court did in Time Warner 2, and where the Congress said, look, we don't want to impede the growth on cable. We want to encourage it where it is appropriate. And, you know, the one thing that is extraordinary about this case, apart from the speech impact, which is no small potatoes, is the fact that as the market has been configured for the last several years, and certainly now, Comcast competition has a national footprint. DBS has a national footprint. The telephone companies have a national footprint.
Well, they're not offering this throughout the country.
Not yet. But if you keep in mind the dynamic nature of the marketplace, just as this court did in Time Warner 2, it is a very important point to consider. And just give me half a second to give you two important facts about this. Verizon, first reported subscriber base, I believe September 30th, 06, 118,000 customers in this business. As of the end of last year, 12/31/08, 1.9 million and change, almost 2 million. Think of that growth. AT&T, think March 07, 13,000 customers. As of the end of last year, 1,045,000. As of the end of last quarter, 1,003,000, 250,000 in 3 months. I mean, the notion that you could validate a rule that does not even attempt to take the dynamic nature of the marketplace, as Congress expressly instructed the Commission to consider.
Those facts were after the close of the record.
Oh, but, you know, in an ordinary case, that might not be relevant, Judge Ginsburg, but bear in mind that one of the few attempts that the Commission has made to have any real-world input into this formula came in paragraphs 90 and 91, where it says, we accept, to the extent that it is relevant to the inputs in the formula, current market information that is gathered by, you know, the reputable market publications, and we caution the industry that they should not play games with how they report to these outfits. So it is not so easy as to say that these things are not in the record.
One of the problems in this whole area is it's a moving target. The technology overtakes it, the market structure, the whole business about least access. I mean, I don't know you can justify that.
Judge Randall, and that's a very fair point, but under no stretch of the imagination could that possibly justify having the Commission, having been turned down by this court in 2001, with a statement saying the data are probably too stale for us to even look at it now, then go and having a key set of variables for the next try be 84 to 2001. I mean, that is just completely indefensible, and it is the building block of the formula. And even apart from that.
Your time is out, but I want to ask you one question off the topic that we've been discussing. You challenge the standing of the interveners on the side of the FCC.
Yes, we have.
Okay. There's a long-standing rule in our court and the Supreme Court that for example, if it's petitioners and an intervener comes in and somebody challenges the intervener's standing, that if any of the petitioners have standing, if they're all seeking the same relief, then we don't have to consider that, so long as one of them does. You're familiar with that rule?
Yes, and in fact...
Why doesn't that apply to interveners who come in on the defensive side?
I don't have any issue with the fact that
it does. In other
words,
because the FCC has standing, then why do we care whether the CCTV people have standing?
There are two questions. I mean, there are two cases that answer two distinct aspects of that question, Judge Randolph. Now, the first case is the Rio Grande case, which has to do with why does it matter if we're going to be considering the same arguments anyway? And as this court pointed out in the Rio Grande case, it matters because you acquire the status of a party once you're granted intervener. So
that's true of the petitioner's side as well. So what's this? Yes.
It is true, but you know the point that I was about to make that I didn't quite make is that if the petitioner or the respondent in this case throws in the towel, if you have granted the interveners separately the status of parties, they can seek cert, they can seek en banc. So it is okay to do what you say, as the Rio Grande case said, if you exercise then your discretion essentially to treat them as an amicus. But if the FCC cashes its chips in and says, we've done trying to justify this unconstitutional rule, we haven't been able to do it in 16 years, they would not have any further right to go anywhere.
Well, why don't we deal with that if it ever arises, if the interveners seek further court action on their own without the support of the commission?
Well, because in order for you to allow them to become a party for all of these purposes, you have to determine at the outset that they meet the requirements of Article 3. Now, my second...
Well, but if we say under this established line of cases that we don't have... Well, I guess you're saying there we don't say... We say we don't have to resolve their standing. All the arguments are in front of us.
Well, I think that there is a little bit of a...
Let me just interrupt you, because if in fact... See, that theory, I don't think, washes. And the reason it doesn't wash is the following. That if, in fact, all the other parties go by the wayside and all that's left standing is the intervener who then decides to file a petition for certiorari, then the standing question is directly presented. And if they don't have standing, then the Supreme Court either would take the case and rule against them because they lack standing, or they won't take the case because they lack standing. So I don't know about that argument.
No, but I think before you grant them the status of interveners, which is to make them a party, you would have...
Give them standing.
With all respect, Judge Randolph, if you make them a party, it can only be upon the conclusion that they have standing.
Well, why? I mean, you're a party, and if we decide you don't have standing, you are still a party.
Yes, I'll be a party whose purported petition for a review would then be dismissed for lack of Article 3 jurisdiction. But that obviously we don't have that problem because we're an object of the regulation. But, you know, the second case I was going to cite, Judge Randolph, which I think actually fully supports, you know, the second half of what you were saying, is the military tactics project, where somebody intervened on the side of the respondent agency and this court examined their standing separately and concluded that, in fact, it was obvious because they had a pecuniary interest. But the difference is that the way this court has looked at it, it will look at it, if you will, on a per brief basis. If the petitioner has a brief, that is their standing that you will examine. In most cases, it's obvious. Sometimes it isn't. Interveners on that side separately have to establish the standing of at least one of them, apart from the petitioner, for purposes of proving that they can lawfully be a party. And the same rule obtains on the other side, as the Military Toxic Project case shows. But, you know, I don't want to waste a lot of your time with it, because at the end of the day, the only thing that rises on us is whether they can seek further a review. You always have the discretion.
Raise it, so now we have to decide it. So
well, we have to raise it under this court's rule, because if there is any part of it that may call upon you to exercise your duty to ensure that you lack jurisdiction under Article 3, it is my duty to bring it to your attention. And I will reserve, you know, the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Let me start, Judge Randolph, with the questions you asked, because I think they do go to the heart of the case. This is these questions. Give us some logic and whether paragraph 70 is good enough. And let me start where this court started in Time Warner 2, which is that this is a constitutional case, a First Amendment case, and the requirement that the court indicated the FCC needed to follow in Time Warner 2 was a constitutional requirement that the First Amendment tolerates regulations limiting speech only if the government demonstrates that the recited harms justifying the regulation are real and not conjectural. That's the constitutional starting point. So when the government says to a speaker, I'm not letting you speak to two-thirds of the country, it needs to show that there's a problem. It has a burden. And what was said in the court last time.
You read Time Warner 2 as resting on both the First Amendment and the statutory grounds.
Certainly that section does, and we know that because it used the constitutional words, real, not merely conjectural, which are Turner words, which the court had previously relied on in discussing Turner. So, yes, that part of Time Warner 2.
And in the opening paragraph, I guess, says concluding that the FCC has not met its burden under the First Amendment.
Yes.
As well.
So we have a First Amendment problem. They have a burden. And they rely on a model here, as they did 8 years ago, that assumes a monopoly. It's a monopoly model, and they acknowledge that, to be fair to them, 169. It assumes, it's like the old Ma Bell days, that Ma Bell can do what it wants to you, and you don't have a choice. Tough luck. So they don't have to worry about whether you might switch channels or not. The market is, quote, closed or open, depending. If you're stuck with Comcast, you're stuck with Comcast. That's the model. Now, they acknowledge that, and here's what they say. Okay, we know we have to explain this under the Constitution, and that's the work that paragraph 70 is doing. Paragraph 70 is saying, okay, we used the monopoly model. Now, I think it odd that, by the way, they rejected two other models because they didn't account for DBS and said, well, they're not going to work. I'm looking at paragraph 13 and 33 of the order, but this model that they used is a monopoly model, and here's the problem with what's on paragraph 70, Judge Randolph, and it goes right to your question about whether it's adequate. They've put you in a either-or world. Let's read paragraph 70 heroically for all that it is worth and say that it's fully supported in the record, but you don't believe it is. Here's what it says. It's not a perfectly competitive market. There are impediments. Not a perfectly elastic market. There are reasons people stay. Their model is perfectly inelastic. They say, well, okay, but the world is not perfectly elastic. But that's exactly the question Judge William asked them to consider in Time Warner 2, which is, please draw a connection. It's not good enough to tell me it's not fully competitive. It's not competitive at all. I would like to know. We need to have a connection between the market power and the limit set. And there's no connection. All they say at most is, well, they're impediments to the market. That doesn't mean that they need a 30% limit.
So do you think any limit can be set consistent with the Constitution given the current market?
I'm very skeptical, but I don't think neither court need go that far.
The First Amendment's on both sides of this balance.
Yes, it is.
So they're saying, yes, we're going to curtail you at 30% so that others can be assured of access to be able to speak.
Correct. And they have a burden, because they're curtailing us, of explaining that the curtailment is necessary to have that second thing take place. That's their constitutional burden, and they didn't meet it. They didn't even come close to meeting it. Let me give you another example that shows how odd this rule works. The key thing that they changed to make the 30% fit in this time is called the penetration rate. Let's say I'm a customer, not of Comcast, which is 35%, but of, you know, Time Warner, smaller cable company.
35?
Well, let's pretend it got to 35, so it would create the problem. So this is the problem world. I'm a Time Warner customer. I want to watch a program. It's on Time Warner. Good for me. But three-quarters of the programs on Time Warner, by design, I can't get. That's the penetration rate. Three quarters shut out to me. I can't closed. Now, it's in the real world, I can dial a phone number and get them. I can certainly look at them. Time Warner's not going to respond. It has a massively popular channel. It's put on a little teeny tier. It's not going to move it down. No. Wholly inelastic. Wholly inelastic. It makes no sense. It doesn't. Listen, models are all simplifications of the real world.
Because there's a demand for the program, they're going to move it from a higher tier to a lower one? Sounds to me like they put it there and hope that there'd be a demand for the program so that you'd pay for it.
They're going to maximize their revenue in a market. And it goes to another point that Judge Randolph made, I think.
They do that. I mean, cable companies do that all the time.
Sure they do. And there's no analysis of any.
Move it down from a top tier to a lower.
Absolutely.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. It's a dynamic marketplace. This is this frozen in time. Oh, three quarters shut off to me. As if the Time Warner's not going to shift around, try to make the most money, compete with someone else, compete with DBS. That doesn't make any sense. And not only that, it's completely inconsistent with what the court told them to do. Okay, it's not a perfectly competitive world. The court said, please draw a connection between the market power. Assess the determinants of market power. It's a constitutional requirement, and they failed. They failed utterly. And I'm over my time. I appreciate your patience. Any questions of me?
Thank you, Mr. Schneider.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good to see you again. May it please the court, my name is James Carr, and I represent the Federal Communications Commission. The one thing I'd like to start out with as an overview is to rebut the notion that somehow the order that the court reversed in 1999 and the order now before the court are exactly the same. The process didn't change at all.
Only the bottom line stayed the same, right?
The bottom line stayed the same, Your Honor, but the process here was much more rigorous. The data were more extensive. The economic analysis was more sophisticated. Consider, for example, in calculating the minimum viable scale, the commission in 1999 considered less than 100 networks, all of which were successful. In this case, the commission considered more than 300 networks, and it considered those that succeeded as well as those that failed over a nearly two-decade period.
It's some of the data is 20 years old, right?
That's right, Your Honor, but keep in mind, if you're going to do a survival analysis like this statistically, you're going to need a long period of time to review successes and failures.
Does it make sense to look at 20-year-old data when DBS wasn't a competitor back then?
Your Honor, I think this may go to the question of should the commission have added some years at the end to take into account DBS. I think that goes to the point that Judge Ginsburg was making earlier. At some point, the record has to close. Keep in mind what was happening
here. To a broader point, you started by saying comparing 2001 to now. Well, first of all, change. You're no longer relying on collusion. And without that, it would seem that the first opinion suggested a 60% limit was about the best you could do or higher.
Again, assuming on that
and
record.
Since, so if you start with that as the baseline, and then you come back, DBS, there's less vertical integration, there's networks, there's 565, take or give a few.
There's also
a huge increase in the diversity of video programming since 2001, when at that time we said 60%.
There's also an increase in the amount of tiers, and as a result, the penetration rate that the commission, basically the commission did a back-of-the-envelope calculation of a penetration rate back in 1999, and it came up with 50%.
Is that what the court was told?
Probably not at the time.
I don't think
so. It was
so
long ago, Your Honor, I can't remember.
So,
But I think if you look at the 1999,
didn't say it was a back of the envelope.
If you look at the 1999 order, Your Honor, it's clearly a rough estimate, and I think the court actually or the commission did use the term rough estimate. In this order, the commission took specific data dealing with the real life experience of 135 cable networks. And actually did regression analysis to determine the penetration rate. The reason the penetration rate dropped was because more of these channels were now being placed on digital tiers. Not as many subscribers were subscribing to digital tiers, and that resulted in a decline in the penetration rate. And that's the principal reason why it may have appeared in 1999 that you could have a 60% limit for just
one. If you're a network or a video programmer, first of all, the cable operators aren't the gatekeepers. The broadcast and non-broadcast networks are the gatekeepers. If you're trying to produce a documentary about the history of baseball, you're not selling it to Comcast or DirecTV. You're trying to place it with PBS or MLB or ESPN.
I understand, Your Honor. I understand that point. I'd like to make the point, though, that I think Comcast is incorrect about the statute applying to a video programmer in the sense of someone producing independent episodes of programming. The reason for that is, if you look at the way it's used in the statute,
That next provision, right?
The next provision, there's only one way a video programmer can occupy a channel, and that's what.
Isn't it most reasonable to read video programming in 2A to, even if it includes networks, it certainly has to include also independent programming?
Well, maybe so, but I think the way Congress was trying to get at the problem was in dealing with, in a cap that would deal with the survival of networks.
It was F1B, right, that uses video programmer in a way that you say
that's correct
refers to means network. But when they're using the term video programming in 2A, it would seem logical to think that Congress was referring to the placement of shows.
Except
and
that it's
content
also saying,
on that get into the home.
It's also saying video programming from the video programmer to the consumer, and obviously it's the cable industry or the MVPD industry that intercedes there. They're the ones who make the call as to whether the video programmer gets on the systems. The point was also made in the House report from 1992, which I believe is actually cited in our supporting intervener's brief at pages 3 and 4. But the relevant language from the House report currently, the largest MSO controls access to almost 25% of all U.S. cable subscribers. Although this percentage may appear low relative to other industries, the committee believes it may be quite significant depending on the subscriber level needed to launch and sustain a cable programming service. I think in that context it's clear what Congress is talking about is a network, not some sort of independent programmer.
The statutory debate we're having illustrates a broader issue for the constitutional analysis, right, which is one of the interests asserted here is diversity. And there's just been a huge increase in diversity of programming since 2001, since 1993.
There's
Judge Williams' opinion for the court indicated, at some point the incremental increase in diversity no longer is an important interest. Going from, even if we take it as networks, from 565 to 566 networks, I'm not sure that's sufficient under the First Amendment to justify a restriction on speech, is it?
Well, keep in mind, though, Your Honor, it's not just about diversity either. There's also the interest in competition.
I know, but I want to deal with them separately. But on the diversity front, it seems at this point it's achieved diversity.
You could argue that, although some would say that there's still, I mean, there's still room for good programming.
Always going to be true. The question is just whether this interest hasn't been attenuated by the proliferation of programming sources.
Well, you could have a situation where even in a world with 300 channels, if a new network wants to get on a cable system and it approaches Comcast, Comcast says no, it's unable to get in.
A new network, it'll try with DirecTV.
It will try, and the point is, if the cable operator is large enough that the open field doesn't give the new network a fair chance to compete, it may not make it even though it provides, let's say, and I know Comcast is, has talked a lot about these niche networks in its briefs. There may be competition within niches. There may be just one nature channel on your cable system. Maybe a second nature channel comes along.
It may prod the
first one to become better.
You agree, of course, that the cable operators and the DBS operators are speakers for purposes of the First Amendment, right?
I do, Your Honor, yes.
You think Congress could limit bookstore owners to 30% of the market? Barnes & Noble can't go beyond 30% of the national market in selling books?
Or carry more than 30% of the books?
No, I don't.
Why not? What's the difference?
It depends on the particular market structure. I think here you have a situation.
The shares according are similar, how about a newspaper? In many metropolitan areas, there's a single newspaper that's effectively the sole source of.
Assuming they're still in business.
Right. Yes. There might be zero, but if there's one, could the D.C. City Council say the Washington Post can't be more than 30% of the home subscribers in Washington, D.C., do you think? Because we want to increase the diversity and competition of op-ed opinion that gets to the people.
I doubt that it could.
Why? On the First Amendment, how can it possibly be that if the governmental interest is promoting diversity, how can that be not content-based? The entire essence of it is content-based.
Well, Your Honor, Judge Ginsburg actually addressed this in Time Warner One. The idea is that the concern is not with what the cable operator might say, but that it might not let others say anything, and that there's the possibility of allowing different voices in what is a limited marketplace.
Still content-based.
It's not
viewpoint. I agree with you.
Well,
it's still content-based.
I would still say, though, it's not a situation where strict scrutiny comes into play, as Judge Ginsburg found in 2001.
Well, I know we've crossed that bridge. Anyway.
Yes.
Couldn't strict scrutiny come into play because of the speaker-based classification? The distinction. What I don't understand is Time Warner and Comcast are subject to this limit, which I think they're 1 and 4, but 2 and 3, DirecTV and Dish, are not subject to the limit.
Well. Again, Your Honor, if you look at those cases that deal with the speaker-based distinctions, usually what happens there is the courts look at the speaker-based distinction and determine if there is evidence or reason to believe, suspicion that that distinction is based on some content consideration, a disapproval of.
I agree some of the cases do, although Turner 1, it really just said, well, cable is the monopoly. Satellite's just getting off the ground. It's not really a serious player at this point, and therefore, we're not going to give strict scrutiny to the speaker-based distinction. Plus, there was no indication that DBS was in a position to threaten local broadcast television.
And this court's
but the language leading up to that suggests that speaker-based classifications do trigger strict scrutiny or are very dangerous for the government to engage in.
Well, this court's opinion in Bell South, which interpreted some of that language from Turner, emphasized that so long as there's not some sort of evidence or suspicion of a preference for content or disfavoring content, usually you're not going to apply strict scrutiny to these sorts
of
speaker-based distinctions.
Problems. I mean, when you mentioned evidence, are you talking about the evidence before Congress during the hearings? Or are you talking about the evidence that would be presented to a court? And isn't it possible that Congress, for example, in 1992, may have had a perfectly valid basis for passing the statute, but the evidentiary foundation has completely eroded? So a statute constitutional in 1992 could be flatly unconstitutional in 2009.
I think that's definitely a concern in a situation where you're talking about a statute from so long ago. if there, but that, again, I don't think that would cross the line from intermediate scrutiny to see that. You wouldn't apply strict scrutiny necessarily if the rationale for the regulation had gone away over time. You would presumably just rule that under intermediate scrutiny, there no longer was a real problem anymore to address. We still believe.
Isn't that the situation here?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I believe that there is still the cable industry generally still has about 2/3 of the market, and as we pointed out and as the Commission pointed out in its order, there is not this sort of easy elasticity when it comes to single new networks. You're not going to find a Comcast subscriber when Comcast decides not to carry a new network. That subscriber is not going to go to DirecTV just to get that one new network. I would acknowledge.
Has that happened with NFL Sunday Ticket?
And that's probably the exception that proves the rule. The NFL is the 800-pound gorilla in all of this. They can charge pretty much anything.
I thought a lot of people switched to DirecTV because of that.
A lot of people do, but again, that's an exception for most new networks.
Did that happen with a Yankees network too?
I don't know, Your Honor. I try to ignore news about the Yankees, but anyway. I think, though, there is still the effect that DBS competition has, I will grant, is that, and this is to some extent, I believe, what Mr. Estrada was talking about when he was talking about all the investment that cable companies are making in expanding their channel lineups. There's no question if Comcast is offering a channel lineup of 50 channels and DirecTV is offering a similarly priced package of, you know, 75 or 100 channels, there are going to be a lot of people switching because people like choices.
How are they going to know what's in the other programming package?
Well, that's that.
How are they going to incur all those transaction costs? I thought that the answer you already told us in the order that, you know, the world is static. Get used to it.
It is static in a situation. I think what the commission said was people will not switch except where there is a large benefit, a perceived large benefit. And people will switch if they're getting double the amount of channels, even if they don't necessarily know what the channels are. You know, the way men are with the remote, they're going to flip from one channel to the next. The problem is when you're talking about a single new network, and this was the point when Judge Williams was talking about elasticity in his earlier opinion. That was focusing on if one new program network is not carried by a particular MVPD, the subscribers to that could switch to an alternative MVPD that carries that network. And he said the commission at that point hadn't shown why that logic wouldn't apply here. Well, the commission has shown why the logic wouldn't apply in this order.
This has been going on for more than a decade. What evidence is there that the rule, whatever rule, the FCC adopts, it's been 30%, 30%, 30%, has had any appreciable benefit to consumers?
Well, I think there has been expansion in the number of channels while the cap has been in place.
And we know from Comcast's standing argument that it's prevented them from completing an acquisition.
That's what they've said in their reply brief.
But is that good? Is there any reason to think that's good for consumers?
The thing is if the cap is able to enable new programming networks to continue to get into the marketplace, that can be good for consumers.
That's a huge assumption you're making, that it's because of this legislation.
Well,
I mean, that's enormous and unproven and probably unprovable.
The policy call is probably above my pay grade, Your Honor. I honestly can speculate as to the effects, but I know what the commission believes having put this cap into place.
Doing what Congress told?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Can I make another point with respect to Mr. Estrada made an argument about correlation being confused with causality and the successful networks. And the one thing I wanted to point out is it appears from Comcast's brief that what Comcast thinks the commission is doing in this survival study is simply taking the average numbers of subscribers for successful networks and putting them all together and coming out with a minimum. And that plainly is not what's going on. For one thing, the commission is considering failed networks as well as successful networks, so that enters into the calculation in the sense that in the 19 million, yes, Your Honor. That's if you look at the – I confess I don't understand any of this statistical stuff, but the Media Bureau Survival Study, which is in the record, talks about how these various things are taken into account. Failed networks, for example, if a network fails after a certain number of years and it's achieved a certain number of subscribers, that is factored into the analysis in calculating and estimating how many subscribers would be needed to survive at a particular point in time.
The network survival study, as I understand it, looked at the firms that had survived for 5 years.
That's right, Your Honor.
And asked what penetration rate did they have, or how many subscribers did they have access to? Right?
That was part of what went on, yes. The commission had to make a selection of a point in time.
Wasn't that just a simple average?
It was not, Your Honor. If you look at the if you take a look at the Media Bureau Survival Study.
You have a page?
Yes, Your Honor. If you take a look at pages starting at 799 through 801. I will confess I don't know anything about what it is literally Greek to me. My point is that's not the mark of just doing averages. I'm sorry, from pages 799 to 801 in the joint appendix. It basically just looks at how these different probabilities are calculated. And
where's your description of this in the brief? That must be the considered distillation of.
It was a considered distillation, yes. I don't know. Well, let's see where.
There are 5 pages summarizing the order.
The discussion starts at 27 through 31 of the brief on the minimum viable scale. And this, of course, is, as the commission pointed out, this kind of survival analysis is an accepted technique in economics and other technical fields, and this same analysis appeared in a peer-reviewed article in the Journal of Advanced Economics. It's not just a matter of averaging these things. There were variables taken into account. There were parameters that were included in the formula to try to account for unobserved tendencies. For example, if you have two cable networks with similar characteristics, one fails, one succeeds. Why is that? The formula attempted to take all of that into account. It's not an easy matter of averaging. This is not easy stuff. Now the point about
Here's what you're.
Okay.
This is page 30. Third sentence. Thus, an MVS based on a 70% probability of survival was reasonably designed to, quote, reflect the average cable network, close quote. And that's quoting the order at 20.
That's right.
Paragraph 193.
There were two decisions that the commission had to make in deciding how to apply this survival study. One was, at what point in time do you look? The commission chose 5 years because it felt that that gave the network a certain amount of time to develop and get out into the market. And then the commission then chose the probability of success. The numbers in the survival study were, it could have been a 50%, 70%, or 90% probability. The commission chose 70% probability of viability because it looked at the data from those nearly two decades, from 1984 to 2001, and it determined that the standard for the industry was roughly a 30% failure rate, and that's why the commission chose 70%.
Was the Weibull calculation challenged?
I don't know that it's challenged in the briefs here. I know that Comcast submitted some comments from economists.
Is the Weibull calculation done for human beings? Is that what it's derived from? The greater the chances
die. That's part of that. It's used in medical research as well, and right. And the idea being that, you know,
how does that apply to networks? The older the network, the more chance that it'll fail.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. I mean, that has to be taken into account in designing the formula and the variables that are put in. Humans, it's clear that the older you get, the less likely you are to survive. It probably...
Well, the likelihood of surviving is zero, no matter how old you are.
That's right.
Mr. Carr, the study said, the same study that we were talking about also says that those networks that survived needed 10.18 million subscribers to get when they got started.
Well, that what it says
maybe had that many.
It doesn't say that they have that many. Mm-hmm. It says that if they have, I think if you actually look at,
well, here's a quotation. A network requires only 10.18 million subscribers from day one to have a survival probability of 70% over its first 5 years. Close quote. Okay, now. Let's call it 10 million on day one, is achievable with either of the DBS distributors as well as several of the terrestrial distributors.
I think the thing to keep in mind is we're talking about 10.18 million from day one. Mm-hmm. The data that the commission reviewed for the survival study showed few, if any, networks that actually started with 10 million from day one. And that's part of the reason. Right. There's no.
That's all they would require.
It's possible if they can achieve that. As a general rule, it's a rarity when any network beyond some of the truly popular networks right from the start, some of the big sports networks, it's a rarity when a new network is going to achieve 10 million from day one.
Doesn't that depend on whether they're in the basic tier?
That's certainly one of the considerations. And what you find with most new networks is that they get placed in the most remote tier as a general rule. So you can't necessarily assume that a network is going to get 10.18 million just by getting carriage on DBS, because it depends.
Local station does, though, right?
A local station would get penetration because of the must carry. That's right.
Yeah, a local station in New York,
sure,
gets must carry protection,
sure,
in basic tier. So on day one, it's got probably 10 million subscribers.
That's right. But again, the commission wasn't focused on broadcast network.
I understand
and
that,
if it were,
you know, that's one of the peculiarities that Mr. Estrada mentioned, because
right.
As far as the eyeballs are concerned, it doesn't matter whether it's on a local channel or a cable channel.
I think, though, if you look at it in context, if Congress really intended for broadcasting to be sufficient to ensure the flow of programming, it could have stopped with Muscari. It didn't need to adopt a subscriber limit. It's the Commission's view that when the Congress went ahead and adopted a subscriber limit, it obviously had in mind something more than the channels that were protected by Muscari.
Well, sure. But what it had in mind was assuring a vibrant market for programmers, not so that they're not limited to just their local channels and a single
sure.
cable monopolist throughout
sure.
the country, right?
That's right.
All right. So
that's right.
But that is not inconsistent with counting the broadcasters in your calculation. From the point of view of someone, as Judge Kavanaugh was suggesting, someone trying to sell a program, they're a source too.
They are a source, but again, if Congress,
you have national distribution immediately.
The thing is, if they were also a source back in 1992. They were a source under Muscari. The point
but there,
is,
but there are 560 some odd networks now, right? I mean, there weren't that many networks back then.
Well, I think we were talking about the broadcast networks, right? Oh. But they're
on the same footing as the non-broadcast networks
right.
once the cable is in place or DBS.
Right.
Although they don't necessarily reach unless they're on the basic tier. Those other networks aren't going to reach as
many as the
broadcast.
But they are on the basic tier if they're the local broadcast network.
Oh, sure.
NBC, CBS,
sure.
and so on.
Right? I don't dispute that.
But they're not in the calculation.
The problem is that to include them doesn't really add anything in terms of what Congress was trying to get at. If it were enough to have the broadcast networks available to ensure the unimpeded flow of video programming, Congress could have stopped with the must-carry provision. It didn't need a subscriber
limit.
No,
I grant your point.
Right.
They wanted more than just the broadcast networks, but they didn't want to exclude the broadcast networks.
I see your point, but
Because they're trying to protect, have multiple channels of distribution, right? And those are
right.
Well, those are certain channels.
But again, I think if you look back to the legislative history, the focus here was on cable programming services, not on broadcast networks being carried on cable.
Can you suggest that there's a compelling or even substantial government interest in having the programs carried on non-broadcast cable channels as opposed to broadcast cable channels?
Well, the only thing I would say is it can't just be enough that the broadcast networks are out there, and they provide the flow of video programming. You have to protect.
Not enough, but it's something.
It is,
and you're counting it as nothing.
Well, I honestly don't see what it adds in terms of the viability of the rest of the marketplace for.
Well, it adds five or six or seven outlets that have 10.18 million subscribers on day one. Right, if you get yourself onto Fox or ABC, you're around the country.
I understand that, Your Honor. I still think in context that what the statute was really driving at was the cable networks, not the broadcast networks.
In your brief, you compare the record here to the record in Turner 1 and 2 in saying that this is similarly satisfies intermediate scrutiny, but I read the court in Turner 1 to say intermediate scrutiny is still tough scrutiny, and it's got a lot of references to the importance of free speech, but there was an interest there in preserving broadcast television, and it's a little bit of a bank shot, but the only way broadcast television was going to be preserved was to have Muscari, and there was an interest in that because at that time 40% of the country didn't have cable, right?
Understand.
And a lot of people couldn't afford cable, so there was a whole different, and there was a record of non-carriage that was demonstrated in Turner 2, and there was a record that broadcasters were, when not carried, would go out of business, which is all demonstrated. Right. How does the record here stack up against that? That seems like a pretty substantial record.
Well, I'm not going to tell you that it's precisely as thorough as the record in Turner, but there is...
Which is interesting, because for Turner 1, it wasn't even though a lot of that stuff was in the record in Turner 1, it wasn't good enough for the court.
Well, that may be so, but I think there's enough here to show that without a cap, the cable programming networks will not be able to make it. They will not have sufficient access to other parts of the market in order to get the number of subscribers
that they
need.
Rather inconsistent with your standing argument, isn't it?
How so, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
I understand your argument against Comcast having standing is they're never even going to get close to 30%. They're the largest cable, but their subscriptions are declining, and they appear to be declining into the future. In which case, there's no threat that one company is going to have more than 30% of a share and start cutting out programming. I mean, the two arguments seem to me inconsistent.
The threat, Your Honor, would be, even if it continues to decline, the threat would be if Comcast decided to merge with another cable operator.
And well, they said they did, but for the 30% rule.
They did in their reply brief.
So you concede the standing point.
In their reply brief, they made the point.
So standing out of the case at this point?
If the court decides to accept the affidavit, which we think violates Rule 28A7 of the court's rules, then
you'll ditch standing to preserve your merits argument.
We'll ditch standing. That's right, Your Honor.
It wasn't a merger, was it? I thought it was an acquisition.
Yes.
A stock acquisition.
It was an acquisition. That's right.
And the problem that Comcast ran into is only because of
the attribution,
which is fairly derived, that says if you own 5% of a company, then they have 10 million subscribers, you are attributed 10 million subscribers.
That's fair, Your Honor. That's right. It was an acquisition. That's right. That's right. Well, if there are no further questions.
Sure, I don't have another one, if you would, just a moment. Thank you, Mr. Kerr.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, I'm Andrew Schwartzman. I represent the interveners in support of the petitioner. I'd like to talk about standing. At the outset, I'd like to save this court a lot of work with one brief point about Comcast standing. Just a reminder that if court were to dismiss the petition for review, Comcast can always seek review of the rule on an as-applied basis if it subsequently runs into a problem where it fears that it's bumping against the rule. The Grasibus case and the functional music line of cases make that clear.
How would it do that?
Yeah. Go ahead.
How would it do that? Let's say it's coming forward with or wants to make an acquisition.
It would go to the FCC and allege that at that time that it was violating either its statutory or constitutional rights and present it and seek review of the rule as substantive challenge to the rule based on its application to it in that circumstance.
It would have to actually make the acquisition at its peril.
It would apply, which it has to do. It has to apply to the FCC for approval, and it could do so at that time.
Before it can complete the acquisition.
Before it could complete the acquisition. And, of course,
in that case, there's not going to be a deal, right?
Well, It's unclear. The FCC has tended in the past in that kind of situation in broadcast transactions to approve the transaction conditioned on with a waiver conditioned on the outcome of litigation. So it does have that opportunity. The other point, which has already been addressed here, Judge Ginsburg, is you've relied on Comcast's reply brief, the declaration attached to their reply brief, and the wisdom of the logic, persuasive logic, I may say, of the Sierra Club decision is that such information has to be submitted with the opening brief and not the reply brief, and that was recently reiterated in the Core case. I'd urge you to disregard that declaration.
Comcast is the object of the regulation here. That, I mean, our standing cases are more difficult when it's a third party challenging a regulation, because usually because it's under inclusive of a regulation of someone else.
Yes,
those are the tough cases.
I agree.
And under Lujan and whole string of cases, and every case we hear that's a regulatory case, when the object of the regulation challenges, it's usually
I agree that's generally the case, but the three lines that Comcast put in its initial brief, standing by itself, in light of what the FCC put forward in its brief, the chart showing that Comcast, as has been discussed, is going down, not up, suggests that the injury is not imminent, and as I said, it would save this court a lot of work.
Sierra Club, we anticipated this by saying that if they're the subject of the regulation, then ordinarily standing is obvious. So they come in and say, we have standing because the rule governs our conduct. The government comes back and says, well, their penetration is diminishing. They're not near 30%. But that's only one way in which the rule can bite. So Comcast comes back and says, well, that's all as it may be, but we can't do an acquisition.
Well, if they had said that in their initial brief, I'd agree with you, Your Honor. I think saying in the reply brief comes too late, and that's the teaching of this court, and it's explicit in Rule 28A7.
Well, when they say we're limited by this rule because we can't go up above 30%, they have to specify the various ways in which they might go above 30%.
They have to specify that that this has or will directly impact them in their day-to-day operations and give some remote kind of example. They just simply said, we're subject to the rule. That's really analogous to what this court rejected and what I want to get to, which is our standing in Rainbow Push.
How do you get to that? At Time Warner 2, the opinion says that this rule is going to be felt mostly with respect to mergers and acquisitions.
I agree that's correct, Your Honor.
So if that's the case, and you have a public corporation like Comcast, which is under the government regulatory thumb, prohibiting certain mergers and acquisitions, how can you possibly say they don't have standing? The only way that you could do that is to say that they have absolutely no prospect of ever engaging in a merger or acquisition.
That
seems fanciful.
If that's the law, you're correct, Your Honor. I'm not sure that's the law. I think that imminence...
I wanted to say what I
said. Yes, it did. I think that there has to be some showing. For example, if a brand new cable operator came in with less than 1% of the market and wanted to challenge this rule because it was going to interfere with future acquisitions, I think this court would have a lot of trouble with that. And the question, is 26% a different situation, is a legitimate question, but I suggest that the Comcast hasn't made the requisite showing. My red light is on.
What about your own standing?
With respect to our own standing, we made three separate but related claims of standing. As programmers of local PEG channels, it was alleged that there's ongoing harm from increased concentration, not speculative harm, but actual ongoing harm that would get worse as concentration increased over 30%. It's demonstrated in the record, and then there's a declaration which affirms what's in the record, that the increased concentration of cable companies increases the cloud of cable companies with respect to local franchising authorities and interferes with cable programmers such as CCTV who are attempting to get their PEG channels on the air. As subscribers to cable, we argue that this is completely self-evident, that United Church of Christ comes within the ambit of the statute that describes the harm, and then this is critical. Because the, for purposes of standing, the assumption has to be made that the FCC is correct, that there's a real non-conjectural harm that would arise if cable operators attain 30% or greater capacity. That is the harm that UCC relies on. It's the assumption that comes with being an intervener in support of a respondent that makes this case different from some of the other cases that Comcast relied on. In Rainbow Push, for example, it was going up against the FCC that had found that the duopoly rule was no longer an obstacle for diversity. Here, the assumption has to be that the FCC is correct and that the harm is real and non-conjectural. Unless the court has any...
The harm may be real and not conjectural for program producers, which is CCTV. But why is that true for UCC?
Well,
they're viewers, aren't they?
They're viewers, and Joint Appendix 505 to 506, comments that UCC was a signatory on, allege that in addition to the disparate impact on local franchising authorities, it states that that this reduction in the introduction of local programming options impedes the flow of programming to subscribers, which is the statutory standard. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Estrada owe us? Take a few minutes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Three quick points. Number one, this is not a question of Greek versus English. You know, the issue here is not whether the agency should learn Greek or knows Greek. The issue really is whether they can be troubled to read the conclusion in plain English in the very statute, in the very study that they actually cited.
But your grant is not just a simple average, right?
Well, it is an average of sorts. And taking all of that into account, turn to the conclusion page, and the number is 10 in plain English and not 19. Point two, on the question of the exclusion of the broadcast stations, I just want to point out that more turns on it than whether you add a few broadcast stations, because that changes the statutory analysis that the Commission employs from networks to programs. And if you do that, then all of the outlets are not merely the broadcasting networks, but also hundreds of existing cable and DBS networks. Finally, third, and probably my most important point today, vacator. We asked for it. The commission in the brief did not oppose it. I did not hear a word today on the question of why, if we are right, there should not be vacator. This case ruling in Fox Television says that vacator sometimes, as in here, after repeated efforts at the same outcome, may be appropriate under the EPA, but if the court finds that it is also a violation of the First Amendment, then, as Judge Ginsburg said in Fox TV, then vacator is required. 16 years of an unconstitutional rule with endless attempts at justification, all of them unsuccessful, are enough. I respectfully ask that the court reject this new attempt and vacate the rule. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Estrada, Mr. Carr. Thank you all. The case is submitted.